Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Are you running an e-commerce business, doing amazing sales, but being crushed under the holiday volumes? Not if you were using Whiplash, modern fulfillment built to scale. As a Hack the Entrepreneur listener, you will get $100 credit when you sign up today. Go to getwhiplash.com/hack. Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I am your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is a former product manager, consultant, writer, snowboarder, father of four, and an entrepreneur. As you will hear in this conversation, my guest was born with the entrepreneurial instinct and desire to create. And even though life tried to get in his way, he continued to write and create while working full-time and still having time to hang out with his family. He's a relentless maker, with a list including marketing for developers, product, people, club, network effects, and remote workers, and much, much more. He is also the author of several books, including Amplification, The Product Hunt Handbook, and his latest book, Jolt. He is also the host of the Mega Maker podcast. Now, let's hack Justin Jackson. About a year ago on my show, I had the pleasure of interviewing James Marks. He's from Michigan, and he's formerly a punk rocker turned brilliant entrepreneur when he started Whiplash Merchandising. And I'm so happy that him and his company decided to sponsor Hack the Entrepreneur this month. If you are running an e-commerce business, Whiplash is your virtual warehouse. You send your products to a Whiplash facility, and when your customers order, Whiplash ships it to them just like you would, but faster and cheaper. With warehouse facilities in Detroit, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and London, Whiplash will get your products to your customers faster, no matter where they live. Plus, Whiplash connects easily with major shopping carts like Shopify, Magento, and Bandcamp, so you can get up and running faster. Remember, if you were crushed under holiday volumes and in over your head, you would not be if you were using Whiplash. Contact Whiplash now so this goes down in history as the last holiday you shipped yourself. Don't get stressed out. Get Whiplash. Go to getwhiplash.com/hack right now. And for being a Hack the Entrepreneur listener, you're going to get $100 credit for getting started today. That's getwhiplash.com/hack. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very special guest all the way from Canada. Justin, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, John. It's good to be here, man.
Absolutely my pleasure, man. I've wanted to have you on for, I'm going to say, a couple of years. Been just over a couple of years I've been doing this, but you've been on my radar for a long time.
Wow.
And I finally, glad I reached out to you.
Well, it's good. It's good. Yeah, man. It's good. I'm glad we could make it happen.
Yeah, totally. Let's jump into it. Justin, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your success so far?
Okay. Well, I mean, the biggest thing I think has been building an audience. And maybe I'll clarify that by saying even when I wasn't ready to be a full-time entrepreneur, I was doing things and telling people about it. I was kind of involving myself in a specific community of people. And in my case, it was product people, product managers, founders, bootstrappers, whatever that, you know, circle ended up being. And by writing blog posts and then telling people about them, by creating a podcast and then, you know, telling people about it, by doing little projects, building little apps, and then telling people about it. That's, I think, how I've built an audience. And and if it wasn't for, you know, having that group of people that have followed my work, I don't think I would have gone. I just went independent in January. I don't think I would have done it because it's kind of like the foundation everything else gets built on. So if you have a good target market, that's one thing. If within that target market, there's people that pay attention to you, that's even better.
Yeah. And this idea of doing things and telling people about it before you even had something to sell, just moments before we started recording, I found out that you started like full time for yourself just this past year. And I have to say, I was shocked about it because you've been this presence in my Twitter stream, in my email inbox, on my podcast player, on my phone, for years.
Yeah.
That I just assumed that this is like, I actually can't get my head around how you've done everything you've done and also like had a full-time job on the side. And like the job was your side hustle sort of thing.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, so the background to that is, and I've been a lot more open about this recently. I haven't, for a long time, I didn't really kind of tell people about it. But, you know, my wife and I started having kids really young. We got married when we were 21 and we had our first child at 22. And then we've had four more kids.
Oh,
sorry, four kids total, not five kids total, just four. And
all right,
just four. And at the time, I'd always been interested in entrepreneurship. Do you remember on CBC, there was this show called Venture?
Yes.
Do you remember that? It came on after like the 11 o'clock news. The host was this guy named Robert Scully. And then eventually there's other hosts. But when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, I loved that show. And I loved the idea of owning my own business. I when I was 11, I was like, you know, going to the library and reading Business Week and all the, you know, entrepreneur magazines. I was super into the idea of doing your own thing and running your own business. And one of the things I'd always wanted to do as a kid was have my own snowboard shop. And so around that time, early 20s, recently married, brand new baby, my wife and I and some other partners started two snowboard shops. And that ended up being not a good thing. And partly because I just couldn't dedicate enough time to it having young kids. It was like either the business needed all my time or my family required all my time. And so after that happened, after that, those shops closed down and kind of dealing with the subsequent, we had all this debt we had to pay off from the shop. And, you know, once we got through that stage, my wife and I said, you know what, let's not do another business full time until all of our kids are in school. And so that just happened. Last year, my youngest was in grade one. And so that's kind of the context around that. I've been this guy that's just been itching to start a business again since I was 22. And now I'm 36. And I was just waiting for the right time. And along the way, though, because it's not like you can just shut that part of your brain off, I was doing little experiments. I was, you know, writing in my blog, I was podcasting. And in retrospect, I'm glad that I did, because I think a lot of these things take longer than people realize. And when you have a lot of pressure, for example, to like quit your job and start a business right away, but you have no idea who your customer is, you have no leads, you have no relationships in industry, you have no network, it's a lot harder. And so this kind of constraint that we put on me ended up being, I think, a good thing.
Yeah. And it is. And I guess it's because it was a self-imposed constraint, and that causes, usually it forces creativity out of you and to work within it, right?
Yeah.
And it did push you to build that audience.
Yeah. And you know what? Something else I've been thinking about actually is, you know, when I was 22, I mean, I had been on the internet since I was 13, since Mosaic came out in 93. I was on the internet before that, when it was just Usenet groups and like Gopher and, you know, going to FTP sites. So I knew about the internet, but I had no kind of imagination for like running software business or, you know, any of that. Like, I, in my mind, a business was like running a snowboard shop. And over time, I think my understanding of what was possible got expanded. And if I jumped right into, you know, building something when I was 25, I wouldn't have been ready because I didn't understand what was possible. I would have picked something, maybe, I don't know. I would have restricted myself to what I already knew about. And it was, you know, when I turned 28, I stopped working for this nonprofit and I switched to the software industry. And that job kind of opened my eyes to, whoa, like there's people, like there's entrepreneurs running software as a service businesses. There's entrepreneurs running online training businesses. There's people creating, you know, all these specifically digital products. And that was something I'd never kind of considered before. I might have thought about consulting and, you know, building websites or something like that. But it wasn't until I started that job that I was like, whoa, this is a business. Like, people are doing this and earning revenue from it. So I sometimes have like this thought of, if I'd only started when I was in my early 20s, I'd be so much further ahead. But I think the truth is that I hadn't run into enough people that were doing what I'm doing now to even know it was possible.
And to what you kind of probably should be really doing, right? Like, I mean, if you had started when you were 20, you'd probably have a whole bunch of snowboard shops right now. I don't know. But yeah, you wouldn't have been exposed to the potential of just the scalability and also like the geographic sort of freedom of software, right? And where you can create from where you want and still reach and scale across thousands or millions of people, right? Which you can't do with a snowboard shop.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was the part that was attractive to me, was this idea of freedom and specifically like, well, I mean, it's all freedom. There's different types of freedom, but location freedom became important to me, you know, in my late 20s. I started feeling like I don't like commuting into Edmonton every day. It was like an hour in and an hour out. My wife didn't like the cold in Edmonton. And so we started looking at like, oh, it'd be great to live somewhere else. And, you know, at first it was like, oh, could we move here? And then, you know, my work would say, well, no, you can't move. You have to stay here. And kind of pushing up against that and eventually, you know, getting to work remote. But then it was always like, okay, what's the next step? Like, how can I continue to make progress towards this ideal of not being beholden to anybody and, you know, getting to live where I want to live, which in my case is this little city in the interior of British Columbia that has no tech community, that if you want to live here, you basically need to have, you know, you can't depend on the local economy for your livelihood. So because I wanted to live here, that became kind of the motivation behind, I want to have a business where it doesn't matter where I am. I could be anywhere.
Yeah. I love it. So your one thing is that the idea that you built an audience, right? You did things and told people about it before you even had something to sell. Mm-hmm. Now, Justin, as we both know, all the business blogger expert people talk about this whole 80-20 rule. You're supposed to do 20%, get 80% of the results, do what you're good at, and then delegate the rest. Can you, Justin, tell me something that you're absolutely not good at in your business?
Oh, man. I'm not good at delegating, for sure. I mean, this always changes, right? Because you struggle with things and then you get better at them. The first mistake I made when I went independent in January was, you know, I had all this kind of like pent up creative energy. You know, I'd been waiting whatever it was, well, 15 years, more than that. Yeah, probably 15 years to get to this point where I would run my own business again. And I had all these ideas of creative projects I wanted to do, and I just wanted to do them all at once. So I spent this first 6 months of, you know, my independence just working on tons of things, many of which had no kind of path to revenue. They were just like things that were interesting to me. I think that's something else I've learned about myself is I don't know if some people think an entrepreneur is someone who's motivated by money, but I don't think I've ever really been motivated by the money. I've always been motivated by the work. And so just getting to work on all these different things was so fulfilling. But then from, you know, June, so January to June, I realized, holy shit, I need to make some money. And and that idea of like, I've got nothing coming in right now. Ah, like, this sucks. That was kind of a wake-up call that one thing you need to do, especially if you're kind of doing what I'm doing, which is, you know, most of my income comes from an online course I created called Marketing for Developers. And if I don't have kind of like the next thing to launch or the next thing to update and relaunch, there's no money that comes in. Like, you kind of have to have this continual pipeline of things that you're working on. Or you need to focus on building up one asset, like, you know, web application that you just like build up revenue gradually over time. But there needs to be some sort of pipeline. And, you know, since June, I was like, okay, the next things have to all have a path to revenue. So I think I've gotten better at that. But that was definitely something, a mistake I made, was just being motivated by the work and my own curiosity. And I think that's good. Like, it's good to have things that maybe you don't make money from that are just help you to think differently or kind of, you know, satisfy your curiosity. But that has to be the 20, not the 80. So, yeah.
I think that's one thing. No, man. No, yeah, I totally understand that whole, like, it's not about the money, the whole entrepreneurship as not that. Because I fully have realized this about myself in the last couple of years that I like making the money and stuff, but it doesn't motivate me the way I feel that almost it should to maybe push me to build things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't. And it's not inherently good or bad. It doesn't matter, but it is something, right? But so that's changing now. You said the next six projects, like, coming forward. Is that what you said? Or the next few?
I don't necessarily have, yeah, not six, but so I relaunched.
Because you have a lot of projects, man.
Yeah.
Like, you have your, on your site, you have your what? Like, what you're working on or have worked on. It's like, geez, man. Like, yeah. It's an impressive list of things. You have two software projects currently in beta,
yeah,
according to your site.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, again, like, I think it's okay to start things, but you also have to close things, and you also have to, eventually you have to double down on what's working. So I have a little web app that I built with my friend Marty called Network Effects. And then him and I built another little project called Remote Workers Club. And basically they're both still running and they both have paying customers. They're not going to be a significant part of my income though for a while. And with any project, the question I'm asking is, you know, do I like this? Do I want to keep doing this? Is there kind of a path forward to doubling down on this and having a good return on investment? And with software specifically, you know, it's going to be a slow build if you're, you know, getting new monthly customers every month. Like, you know, you get your first customer, that's whatever, $25 a month. And then you get, next month, you get another customer that's $50 a month. And eventually you want to be able to grow that faster, but it takes a long time. The other question I've been asking with specifically software businesses is if I want to run a software business. All my friends that have done that, and some of them have been super successful, to get over $1 million in revenue, you have to hire people. And often you have to hire people even before that, before you're ready. And I don't know if I want to have employees. And so I wrestle with those questions too. Like, do I want to, you know, do I want to keep being a solopreneur where really the only people I'm accountable to is my family. Like, did I feed you guys this month? But having the stress, and that's enough stress already, you know, but having the stress of like having to provide for someone else's family and then, you know, three families, six families, 10 families, even when things are going good, I think people feel that pressure. And I've been in that position before, and I don't know if I want to go back to that. So,
well, when I asked you what you're like not good at in your business, you said delegation, which mm-hmm. that's management mm-hmm. to a certain degree, right? That's
yeah.
like, so is it maybe like software? I mean, the whole lead up, the first half of this conversation was about how you wanted to create software. Mm-hmm. You saw that it was something, not snowboard shops, software shops mm-hmm. that you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's like dabbling in projects, thinking, trying to figure out like, or seeing if one catches, or you answer mm-hmm. those questions about monetization, all that stuff, mm-hmm. but then wondering if that's what you really want to do, because maybe you don't want to build that team. Like, is it because you don't want to build the team, or is it because you don't want to like try and push yourself to be that manager?
Yeah, I mean, it could be a bunch of things. It might just be that at this stage, you know, I've only been independent for a year. And so at this stage, I'm like, this is great. Like, I just work on projects and I launch them. There's no technical overhead. There's no staff overhead. There's no really very little infrastructure overhead. It's just me and a laptop and a microphone, a camera, and that's it. You know, that's enough for me to do what I'm doing. And that might change. But I think right now, I just like the fact that there's no overhead. Mm-hmm. And also, like I said, I've always been motivated by the work. And so I still have no, I've tried so many times to like hire an assistant, or, you know, look into a virtual assistant. And I just have no idea what they would do for me. Maybe some administrative things. But I think, man, even something like answering email or scheduling, like I just don't see how I could be helped that much to kind of necessitate what I'd have to invest in that working.
You're good at email. Anytime I've emailed you over the last year, just randomly replying to one of your emails or something, you're right there.
Yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of time replying to email. That's like, and it's part of what I like to do. And I also feel like, so I could automate that, or I could hire someone to do that. But that's where I get all my best ideas, is people emailing right. me and saying, you know, this is what I'm struggling with, or this is a question I have for you.
So but like the idea of like doing it for the work's sake, does mm-hmm. does that, is there like a point of diminishing returns when you put out, say, another book, like your mm-hmm. recent book, Jolt, mm-hmm. excellent book.
Thanks.
I read it like the second day or something it came out.
Oh, thank you.
And it was a success for you, right? As mm-hmm. a launch. Mm-hmm. Does that like, but you've had Amplification, you've had Marketing for Developers, the Product Hunt Handbook, like you've done this numerous times. Like, does it diminish the sort of the work aspect of it, and like the satisfaction from the work? Or when you launch a course like Marketing for Developers, then you revamp it and relaunch it. Mm-hmm. Like that first time, do you ever regain that? Or is it like, oh, I've done this?
Yeah.
I mean, and the satisfaction's not there.
Yeah. I mean, you get a bit of that, but there's like, you're motivated by the work, but the work often sucks, right? So like writing a book is the worst. It's yeah. the absolute worst. And actually lately I've been thinking that this is a good way to put it. I was talking to someone else, and they're like, okay, what's like meaningful work to you? And I was like, well, it has to be something that like I'm engaged in, but I also have to get paid. And so so I think I've always been motivated by the work. And then I realized 6 months in to this year, oh yeah, the work is important, but you also need to get paid. And so like Jolt was a topic I was really interested in. Jolt was a topic I felt like I could offer something to the world about. It offered a challenge. It was uncomfortable. So it felt good to get that out of me. But I also wanted to get paid. And I needed to get paid at that point, right? Because that was like the moment of realization. The impetus behind Jolt was I need to create something that I can sell because I need to earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's nuance to all of this because now that Jolt's out and I think it's done about, I think I'm close to 1,000 copies sold. I've had two kind of thoughts. One, man, there's a lot of chapters in there I would like to revisit. There's a few weak spots that I would like to make better. Maybe I could launch it on Amazon. You know, I have all these kind of thinking. The other thought is, man, writing a book is a lot of work. And I think books are underpriced for the amount of value that they give. Like, you know, if you launch a book on Amazon, it's usually between 99 cents and $10 or something like that. And if you've written a book, you know how much time it takes. Like, it's an enormous amount of time. The research, the writing, the organization, the edits, the revisions, like, it's just like
the self-hatred.
Yeah, the self-hatred, the procrastination. It's like, I think it is, of all the things I've done, it's one of the hardest things you can produce. And then you put it out into the world, and people are used to paying 99 cents to $10 for it, no matter how much kind of value it brings to them. And they're kind of fiercely critical of books. So, you know, if you read reviews on Amazon, it's like, man, like, this person spent $5 on this book and they're really upset about it. And as a maker, after I'd launched Jolt, because it's like one of the lowest priced things I've ever launched, I felt like, oh man, that was a lot of work. And you're opening yourself up to a lot of criticism. And the paycheck at the end of it was, you know, I think it's made $10,000 or something like that, which for a lot of authors, they'd be delighted about. But when I compared that to the launch of Marketing for Developers, which was a more expensive book, $39, and then a video package that was $195, that launch was like $25,000. So in the entire like lifespan of Jolt, this book that is $15, it's made $10,000. But just the launch of this other thing did $25,000 and has gone on to, you know, it's getting close to $100,000 in sales total, right?
That's awesome.
So comparing those two things, yeah, I've been thinking about both of those. So yeah, book is challenging. The work is awesome. Like the work is motivating. Having people read it and love it is amazing. But there's a flip side, which is I want to get paid. And so, yeah, there's a little bit of wrestling in there, I think. And
so just two things.
Yeah.
One's just sort of a preface. But with the Jolt book, you talked about how hard it was. And it is. It's super hard. I've only written one book and it was super hard. It was a lot of that self-hatred stuff going on. And then the reviews, all that stuff. It's just whatever. But yeah. Jolt, when I read it, Jolt seemed the one thing that I really got, not even that I got out of the book, because it was marketing, it was super smart tactics, but I was like, this book is so well laid out and so, like, it seems so easy that, mm-hmm. like that you created it so easily, and I couldn't put my finger on why. Mm-hmm. But as I was like halfway through it, I was like, I need to write a book like this. Like, it was like, I was like, I could write one this weekend. Like, it just felt like that. I don't know why. Like, and like, to me, that's like, don't take that as a negative in any way. That was like, to me, that was like empowering and like, wow. And now to hear that you struggled with it, I was like, how the hell did he write this so well that it just feels so cohesive, which I don't always feel like things I create are necessarily that cohesive and just follow like a linear sort of path.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so that's what I got reading it.
Well, that's great. I mean, it was an easier book to write than Marketing for Developers, for sure.
Right.
The structure was, and I had that same feeling before I wrote it. I was like, I got a great idea. I'm just going to create this outline. And the idea was, what if it was just people are always asking me for marketing ideas and tactics and creative things to do. I'm like, what if I just created a list of 20 of my favorite? And And I've been trying all these things in that, you know, that 6 months of creativity. I've been, you know, trying SMS. I've been trying, you know, creating t-shirts. I've been doing all this stuff. I was like, I'm just going to write about all of these experiments I did. And so it felt like I could write this in a weekend. But even like, that's the thing, is like getting something that feels really simple and readable and cohesive, it takes time. And I mean, I wrote that way faster than a lot of people who write books. You know, I started in June and then I launched it in July or August. When did I start? I can't even remember.
I think it was July. I want to say July because I feel like August was chaotic for me as I was moving, but it wasn't during that.
Yeah. So I think originally I thought it would take me 1 month and ended up taking me two, which isn't a long, you know, a super long period of time, but it always takes longer than you think. And then there's the flip side for people who want to earn an independent income. I'm actually shying away from this advice of writing a book. I think writing a book is super, super hard, and it's actually a hard place to start. If I was starting again, I would start with like workshops, do a local workshop or do an online workshop, start like by offering something for free and then gradually charge something for it. It's just, it's the difference between writing a blog post and being on a podcast. For me anyway, being on a podcast is way easier. It's just, you can speak into the microphone. It's a lot less edited. You know, folks aren't going to write you after this and go, John, your grammar was really off there. You said, you know, this instead of that. Like, no one's going to do that. But in a blog post, people will be like, you know, your grammar's wrong or whatever.
So, they really do that, don't they?
They do. Like grammar's.
I know with emails too. It's like, oh, correcting it. Like, why did you just correct that and hit reply? I don't get that. Like, would you want me to resend it to everyone? It's not what I'm about to do, but I appreciate your effort, sir.
Yeah.
So why, if you had the success with Marketing for Developers as a book, higher priced, and then with a supplementary video course that was also like an upsell to that, and you had such success for it, why didn't you just follow that with Jolt?
I felt like I only had one data point. What do we say in Canada? Is it data? Data. Data. I felt like I only had one data point.
We won't correct
you. And I wanted to try, I was curious. So I felt like, you know, I've got a list of 10, 12,000 people. How hard would it be to get 1,000 of those people to buy the book at launch? And so my original thought was, you know, I can write this in a month, launch it, and I'll make $10,000 this month in the launch. And then maybe I'll make more, you know, residually. But it ended up taking me a lot longer. And I realized getting a sale is hard work. Like getting people to take out their wallet for anything is hard work. And it's just like, you're a music guy. It's like a stream versus a download versus a CD purchase. So people are going to spend money on music somehow, maybe, but maybe that's actually not a good example, but there's this idea that some things just have better returns. And, you know, you could, as a band, you could like fight really hard to get people to pay $1.50 for your MP3, or you could just jack your ticket prices for shows and actually make a living. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. That does make sense.
So I think you're always going to be fighting to get people to take out their wallet. And, you know, if my list was bigger, I might have had more sales initially too. I was also trying to test what percentage of my list would buy something that was super low priced for, you know, something I'd done. And so now I have that data point.
Yeah, I love it.
And it's... You know, I think the key is, I mean, okay, so I'll tell you this too. And I relaunched Marketing for Developers. And in 3 days of the relaunch, it made over $15,000.
Wow.
And so, and I put a lot of work into it. Like there's you know, it was work, but the amount of the return on investment versus writing a book is much greater. And sometimes it just comes down to how people perceive value. Video feels more valuable at this point in time, and books have been devalued for years. And so it seems silly, like the content is, you know, very similar. Video has the added benefit that I can show people multiple steps. You know, in a book, you can only describe it or show a screenshot. But, you know, the difference between what people are willing to pay is astounding and interesting. And as an entrepreneur, if you're trying to hack the entrepreneur, you have to kind of think, well, am I going to like beg people to stream my music on Spotify? Or am I just going to focus on, you know, building the biggest mailing list I can, so when I come to Thunder Bay, there's at least 200 people that'll show up and pay whatever, $25, $40 to go see a show. And I think that's something I'm kind of thinking about more is, you know, I could get 100 people who are willing to spend good money to see me in concert versus, you know, begging the thousands to just please stream something on Spotify so I can get a few cents.
I like it. And all right, we're going to use this to like wrap up with you because this has been a lot of fun, but let's keep this music analogy going. Mm-hmm. I'm going to see you made really good sense of it. I'm going to see if I can piggyback off that and make any sense at all.
Sure.
But you've been at this game a long time, full time for the past year, but you've been doing this for a long time. Mm-hmm. You've tried a lot of different things, and I love what you're doing, like this idea of building that list now and then finding those 100 people in Thunder Bay or wherever you happen to land.
Yeah.
Is there any urge? This to me comes from like my punk rock sort of sensibility, but is there any urge ever when you're building things, think of them as a band and you're writing a song. Is there ever an urge to maybe try and write a hit? So something you do just takes off and is huge, or do you just want to continually focus on those 100 people in each city and building up a cool living from it?
Yeah. Okay. Oh man, I wish we had another 30 minutes to talk about this, because I'm going to say, I'm going to tell you my thinking, but I also want to surround what I'm going to say with, okay, let me back up. I'm going to tell you the way I think, but I also am critical of this thinking.
All right.
Okay. So
I like it.
So it's something I wrestle with, but my sensibility is I want to be more like NoFX than The Offspring. And so for your listeners that aren't aware, The Offspring was actually one of my favorite bands in high school. They were just like any other punk rock band. They had come out with, you know, some smaller albums. And then this huge punk rock wave hit pop music. And you could, if you were a punk rock band, you could sell a lot of records. And you could, you know, maybe change your songs so that they were more playable on the radio. That's what Offspring did. They rode that pop wave, and up until the point where you get, you know, songs like Pretty Fly for a White Guy and things like that, that are just like silly pop MTV songs. And they were playing huge, huge venues. And they had hits on the radio, and they were selling, you know, I'm assuming maybe millions of records. I don't know. They were selling a lot of records. And then the punk rock wave died, and Offspring kind of died too. They went from playing arenas to playing like Elks halls again. Do they have Elks halls everywhere?
I don't know. I totally know what you're talking about.
Okay. So
it works for us.
Then there's this other band called NoFX, and around the same kind of vintage, but NoFX never tried to write a pop song. They never tried to write a hit. They were just always about building their fan base kind of organically. So they're going to play, you know, they're going to play the same venues, the same bars. They're going to tour forever. They're going to put out an album every year. And they didn't care about being on the radio. They didn't care about all that stuff. They kind of purposefully separated themselves from that. And they are, to this day, just as popular today as they were when way back then, right? They still play the same venues, and they can still get the same kind of people to come out. And to me, that there was something about that that always resonated with me. You know, I want to be more like NoFX than Offspring, partly because I think chasing the big hit is hard. You know, it's like there's so many things out of my control there. Whereas if I just cultivate this audience that identifies with what I'm writing, identifies with the things I put out, have been tracking with me since I started in 2012, you know, since I started my podcast in 2012. And, you know, a lot of those folks have bought every single thing I've ever put out. And there just seems something stable about that that I like, as opposed to hoping that, you know, I mean, this would never happen, but like Jolt would be on the New York Times bestseller list or something like that. Like, to me, that I, even if that happened, what would that mean? Like, what would I do after that? So I have a huge hit. And then what does that mean? Like, does that mean I have to have another hit? Does that mean I'm only going to be kind of worth looking at while that topic is popular or something? So that's my thinking. I have tried to be critical about that thinking because I think maybe there's the possibility that I'm restricting myself too much, you know, with that metaphor of like, oh, I'm just like NoFX and all you other guys are like, you know, like there's something about that that maybe is not healthy. But up until now, I've liked that image of, you know, just like a hardworking punk rock band that just like they're fine just building their fan base organically. They don't need the radio. They don't need anybody else. They are completely self-sufficient. And even if, you know, their kind of music is no longer popular, they can still show up in town and get enough fans to make a living.
Yeah, I love it. And for those of you that don't know, you did mention a new NoFX album all the time. But like 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago or something a month ago, it came out, the latest NoFX album. And it's so good. So good. They're definitely one of my top bands of all time. I'm obsessed with NoFX. So.
Yeah. And actually, recently I've been getting it more into heavy metal and it's a different scale. But I would say that Iron Maiden has actually shown a very similar path. Bruce Dickinson has this great quote where he says, you know, we're just out here plowing our field. It's a farmer analogy. We're just out here plowing our field and we don't pay attention to what's going on in the other fields. Meaning like we know who our fan base is and we don't like, we're not trying to be anything else except the band for our fans. And again, I think there's something about that in terms of longevity, that you can keep being the band that your fans like, and you don't need to go outside of those bands. You can just keep cultivating that relationship. And yeah, for my type of entrepreneurial brain, that just resonates with me.
Yeah, I like it. Great answer, man. Great answer. So we've reached the point in the show where we need to tell people where to track you down on this here internet. Do you got some links for us, Justin?
Yeah, I write at justinjackson.ca. I'm on Twitter at the letter M, the letter I, Justin, M-I, Justin. I'm that on Instagram and Snapchat. I'm trying to expand beyond Twitter. And my podcast that I'm most excited about right now is called Mega Maker. It's at megamaker.co.
Awesome. So justinjackson.ca is the main hub. There's also links to all of his other projects on there, megamaker.co. I'm going to find links for Marketing for Developers. I'm going to find some NoFX for you to listen to when you get a chance. M.I. Justin is on Instagram and Twitter. I suggest you follow him over there. And I'm going to see if I can dig up a link to that old CBC show Venture. We'll see what we can do.
Yeah, there's a YouTube clip of that somewhere. It's good.
Awesome. Megamaker, the show. Definitely check it out. Subscribe to it over there because it's a killer show. It's so good. And it's one of the only actual podcasts I listen to.
Oh, wow.
At this point on a steady stream. Yeah. So I strongly suggest it. But I'll link to all of that in the show notes for you when you are done jogging, walking, working out, whatever it is you're doing right now. Those will be there waiting for you. So Justin, man, once again, thanks for stopping by. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for taking the time. And I don't know, man, keep doing what you're doing because it's awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, man. I love this. This is, I really identify with your sensibility here. This has been good.
Mr. Justin Jackson, thank you so much again for joining me. It was an absolute pleasure, man, to get to talk to you, to get to share and to just go through that conversation and then share it with you out there listening. Also very cool. I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. I have had Justin on my radar, as I said, for a couple of years now, and I just haven't actually gotten a hold of him to get him onto the show until now. So I hope you got as much out of that as I did. I know that you out there listening might be in the stage where you are starting a business on the side. And I love Justin's story because even during that 10-year period where he was working and being a father, he still just kept creating and making things and building that audience and creating it so that it was ready for him when he could go back to full time, which he did earlier this year. And he's been doing awesome with it so far. So I love the story. I know that it'll relate to the entrepreneurs out there who are full-time building businesses, and then you out there also that are just getting this side sort of hustle going. And I love how Justin kind of crosses over, actually back and forth. He's entrepreneur to side hustler to full-time entrepreneur. So it's a cool, cool story. So it was fun to go through the conversation, but now we reached the point where I need to go back. So I went back and I listened to the conversation between Justin and I. And then I went back one more time and I listened. And that second time through the conversation, there was one thing that Justin said to me. I don't know how I missed it the first two times, but that other time through, there was this one thing that he said that was so very, very clear. It was that one thing. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
This always changes, right? Because you struggle with things and then you get better at them. The first mistake I made when I went independent in January was, you know, I had all this kind of like pent up creative energy. You know, I'd been waiting whatever it was, well, 15 years, more than that. Yeah, probably 15 years to get to this point where I would run my own business again. And I had all these ideas of creative projects I wanted to do, and I just wanted to do them all at once. So I spent this first 6 months of, you know, my independence just working on tons of things, many of which had no kind of path to revenue. They were just like things that were interesting to me. I think that's something else I've learned about myself is I don't know if some people think an entrepreneur is someone who's motivated by money, but I don't think I've ever really been motivated by the money. I've always been motivated by the work. And so just getting to work on all these different things was so fulfilling. But then from, you know, June, so January to June, I realized, holy shit, I need to make some money. And that idea of like, I've got nothing coming in right now. Ah.
And that's the hack. Justin. I love this. I love how you were sorting this sort of out in your head. But first you start off how like things change. We realize we're not good at something, we get better at it. And then you spent 15 years working and you had this creative energy that you spent the first 6 months of your freedom just creating a ton of stuff. And then realizing that, wow, there's no path to revenue and I need to make some money. I love this because this is actually, I think this is the opposite of what, this is the opposite of what I did. When I first got my freedom, like 6 years ago to come online, I created like software and things that like I knew could make money. There was like an immediate path to revenue. Like the first web app I built, it took me like 7 months to build. And it cost me like, I think about $8,000 to get built. But then within like a week of launching it, I had made all that money back. And I kept kind of doing that. It wasn't things that I was sort of passionate about at all, except I was passionate about the business and the idea of creating software that could like generate cool amounts of revenue. And then I could have the freedom. And so I'm not a proponent of like, do what you're passionate about, which I think Justin's kind of alluding to here. Like you have to find this sort of balance that works for you. That's why I like this. Because when I was just creating software in markets that I wasn't interested in, there was something lacking. There was the desire, it wasn't like it was a desire for money. It was a desire for freedom. I think I agree with Justin that I don't have a desire, I don't think, to just make money, but I wanted the freedom that came with the money. And so once I got that, it kind of, there was something else missing, which is where Hack the Entrepreneur came from, because I wanted to, like, I wanted to connect with more people, with smart people doing cool stuff. So I decided to start a podcast, which I had never done in my life, and it freaked the hell out of me, but I did it anyways. And then it sort of branched, sort of, or like crossed the chasm, I guess you could say, where I got to bring in my business insight into something that I'm truly passionate about, but also has a path to revenue. So all I'm trying to get at this is, there's a way Justin did it, and now he's finding paths to revenue after that. There's a way that I did it. We're kind of at polar opposites, but now we're kind of coming into the middle, meaning that there is no true way to do this, right? But you have to be aware of the fact that you do need revenue, and you do need to have, like, I believe, some sort of passion for your market in some way, at least. And that can be strictly that you love building software, that you love building courses, that you love coaching people, whatever it happens to be. I don't believe that it should just be passion, because there's not always money following the passion. But it's really merging those both worlds. Think of the passion on, like, your left hand, and then, like, paths to revenue on your right hand, and try and jam those together. Because in the middle, I think, is where you're going to find the fulfillment, the revenue, and the satisfaction from building cool stuff that also generates revenue. Justin, thank you so very much once again. All right, that was a lot of fun. This brings up an interesting thing, because Justin spent 15 years working and wanting to be an entrepreneur again. And on the side, he kept building an audience. That's his one thing, actually, is building an audience, which I've seen the true power of now since creating Hack the Entrepreneur. And I also created a course around it. And it's at 1000, so 1000, maniacs.com, or you can find it straight off Hack the Entrepreneur. But yeah, it's a course all around how I built Hack the Entrepreneur, building an audience from zero to 1000 true fans, based on content, based on sort of, I guess, as Justin would say, amplification of it, and then through email, mostly bringing people in towards a relationship where you can then create products and sell them to them. But that's at 1000maniacs.com, or just find it straight off Hack the Entrepreneur. And yeah, maybe you're working this job right now too. You want to start building this audience. So when you're ready, you have it, right? Like Seth Godin says, like, don't build a product and find an audience. Build an audience and then find a product that will satisfy their needs. All right. It's been absolute pleasure. Thanks for stopping by. As always, I truly, truly appreciate it. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.